Let me read. I'm going to read out of this other translation today. It's a little more modern sounding. Excuse me, the books are out of order in this one. They have this right before Esther, so. Okay. Chapter 11. Send out your bread upon the waters, for in the long course of time you will find it. Give a share to seven or even to eight, for you know not what evil will be on earth. If the clouds fill, they will empty out rain on the earth. And if a tree falls in the south or the north, the place where the tree falls, there it will be. He who watches the wind will not plant, and he who gazes on clouds will not harvest. As you know not the path of the life breath into the limbs within the full womb, so you know not the deeds of God who does everything. In the morning, plant your seed, and at evening, let your hand not rest, for you know not which will be fit, this one or that, or whether both will be equally good. And light is sweet, and it is good for the eyes to see the sun. Should a man live many years, let him rejoice in all of them, and let him recall the days of darkness, for they will be many. Whatever comes is mere breath. Rejoice, young man, in your youth, and let your heart be merry in the days of your prime, and go about in the ways of your heart and what your eyes see. But know that for all these God will bring you to judgment. And remove worry from your heart, and take evil away from your flesh. For youth and the time of vigor are mere breath. Okay, so verse 1, I'll kind of just go back and forth between these. Okay. Verse 1, cast your bread upon the surface of the water, for in the process of time you may find the profit of it. And that is Ginsburg. And then Alter, this other translation, send out your bread upon the waters, for in the long course of time, you will find it. Does someone have the ESV? Yep. What does that say, Charlotte?
Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days.
Yep. Excellent. Excellent. Glad to have you.
Glad to be here.
Okay, so chapter 11, you are welcome. Oh, sorry. Mm-hmm. Okay. So chapter 11, verse 1. Cast your bread upon the surface of the water, for in the process of time you may find the profit of it. So bread in the East is made in cake-like shape. It's very thin. It's not like a loaf of bread like we would think, but it's more like what we might think of as a pita or naan or tortilla, something like that, a big round cracker maybe even for the Passover bread, which to this day is no thicker than a blade of a knife. It's oval or round and about 10 inches in diameter, so that when you put it into a stream, it would float for a time and be carried away by the current. Hence the force of the illusion in this admonition. We are to be charitable to thankless people when the bread we have bestowed seems as if cast upon the surface of the water, where it is irrecoverably borne away by the rapidly flowing stream. Since we cannot tell whether in the process of time we may reap the benefit of it. The idea here is be generous with others, for we don't know when we will be repaid. To cast your bread upon the waters is to give it away in a manner that might even appear wasteful. To give with no foreseeable benefit, though to trust that in time God will provide a benefit. So repeatedly, Solomon has urged his readers to pursue the opportunities God gives under the sun. And now in verse 1 of chapter 11, he addresses the matter of exercising some faith in making an investment that entails risk. So the traditional view is that Koheleth is referring to almsgiving, or one might say reckless generosity. Proverbs 19:17 has a similar idea. And I tell you, Proverbs 19:17, whoever is generous to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will repay him for his deed. Luke 16:9, and I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwelling. Here, Christ teaches that we ought to make as many friends as we can, for we never know when we might need assistance. And another phrasing of it, send out your bread upon the waters. These words initiate a series of, as Alter puts it, prudential maxims on how to conduct one's life in the face of the unpredictability of events and their deterministic characteristics that are beyond human control. So the sending out of bread on the waters is a metaphor meant to teach that to perform acts of benevolence, for you never know when you yourself might benefit from having done so. Do you guys need a paper? No, no. I'll just give you another one because I printed up like 12 of them or something. You never know. We've ranged from like 6 to 20. So.
Keep you on your toes.
Yeah. Okay.
So is the thought like bread on water, if both somebody uses it and then somebody else puts bread on water and it comes back to you in your day of need?
No, you could, and that's, I mean, we'll get to it in a little more detail, but like if you think of how God might bless you, right? You're generous with others, you give to others. Part of it, so in verse 1, the idea here is it's floating away. Right? You have no idea how it's going to come back to you. It's not that that person is going to return it to you or something. It's just you're kind of throwing it on the waters and it goes away. In verse 2, there is the idea that, yes, there are some people that you would give a portion to 7 or even to 8, for you don't know what misfortunes may come on earth. That the idea there is those people might actually be able to repay you. Mm-hmm.
Mine is cast your bread upon the waters, you will find it after many days, and it makes it sound like it's the same like piece of bread that you put out there.
Yeah. Well, and even in this translation, it's send out your bread upon the waters, for in the long course of time you will find it.
Okay.
But it's not that you're finding that bread, it's that if you think of bread in the sense of benefit or blessing or money or sustenance, something like that, you will find the sustenance again. You will be rewarded later. The promise is not, oh yeah, this piece of bread might wash up on the shore and dry out and then you eat it, right? But you will find reward later. That's the idea. I mean, it's a metaphor. It's not, you know, meant to be taken literally. Okay. So the idea is then continued in the next verse, which is verse 2, be generous to any number of people, for in the course of events, you yourself may end up in need and enjoy a reciprocation of support from one of those you have helped. So the emphasis, though, in verse 1 is the uncertainty of the reward, But the inevitability, let me put it this way. It's the certainty of reward, but the uncertainty of its timing. So you don't know when you're going to receive this reward, but there is a reward in the future. So a question for you guys, if you were guaranteed to get a return when you invest your money, would you do it? So for example, if you put $10,000 away this year, at the end of the year, you get $11,000, would you do that? So would you guys think, get a 10% return or probably if you had the money to spare? Yeah. Sure. Okay, right. Somewhere else you might get more than 10% these days. So what if you weren't sure of when you would get a return or how much it would be? How might that affect your decision? Yeah, you might divide it up and diversify a little bit, right? Sure. Right. No, that's right. So it might cause you to consider how you invest it, right? Spread out some of the risk. Okay. What else? I mean, it's one thing to put your money away and know, oh, I'm going to get 10% in a year. That's an easy calculation, right? But it's a lot different if it's like, well, invest. What if a bank said, hey, put your money in here and you'll get something back eventually. No promise of what it is or when you'll get it or anything. You're not likely to put your money in that environment, unless you wanted to avoid the risk of spending it, which maybe is the case, right? But otherwise, you're unlikely to do it. Now, what if, would it change, how does it change your idea of investing? And this wouldn't be money, but this would be generosity, right? How does it change your opinion of investing if a benevolent God has promised that he'll give you a return? Still don't know what it is or when you'll get it, but would that change your mind in terms of whether or not you'd invest? What do you think, Ed? No. You still wouldn't invest?
I might invest because at the end of Deuteronomy, it says that all God's promises came true.
Uh-huh.
So if he promises the return, it's going to happen.
Yeah. Excellent. So you can trust God to be true to his word, right? But he doesn't promise what it's going to be
or when,
right? It might not be in this life. It might be later in life. And that's what we've been looking at in Ecclesiastes. It might be that I'm generous to Alex, and the way the Lord repays me is someone else entirely is generous to me. Or my car doesn't have trouble when it might have had trouble before. You just don't know how it's going to come to you, right? But you can, Ed, thank you for that, know that God's faithful and true. And if he promises to reward us for our generosity and kindness to others, we could believe that. Okay? So the question is, you know, we say this at least theoretically, but do you give in a way that is consistent with that? And I don't mean just to the church, right? I mean, in fact, this isn't necessarily talking about just giving money to the church, but rather being generous to people when you don't see any reward for it. And as Charlotte, can you think of some other ways you might be generous other than with money? Can you think of any ways you might be generous other than with your money?
Your time.
Your time. Okay, you could be generous with your time. If you go to spend time with someone, that often is more difficult to do. In some ways, it's very easy to give money, right? It's harder to stop what you're doing and go and spend time with someone. Okay. All right. Verse 2. Give a portion to 7 and even to 8, for you know not what misfortune there may be upon the earth. So the idea there is the 7 or 8 is the same kind of formula you see elsewhere in the Old Testament. A couple examples are Ecclesiastes 4:6 and 4:12. And this form indicates that there are more potential entities that match the description than just the 7 or 8. A way we might say that today is something like, he knows a thing or two. So this increasing, escalating number series doesn't just indicate 1 or 2 or 7 or 8, but rather an indefinite number of things. We could look at a few examples of that in scripture. Alex, if you could look up Isaiah 17:6, Ed, Job 5:19, and then Zach, do you have a Bible?
Yes.
Would you read Micah 5:5, and we'll start with Alex. Whenever you're ready, Isaiah 17:6.
Gleanings will be left in it, as when an olive tree is beaten, 2 or 3 berries in the top of the highest bough, 4 or 5 on the branches of a fruit tree, declares the Lord God of Israel.
Right. So again, it's not a literal 2 or 3 berries at the top and 4 or 5 fruits, right? It's the idea is an indefinite number, right? A quantity of them. Ed? Job 5:19.
He will deliver you from 6 troubles, and 7 no evil shall touch you.
Okay, so do you think he means only 6 or 7? And no more?
No.
Right, just he will deliver you from troubles. That's the idea, but it's a concrete way of showing that. Okay, Micah 5:5.
And he shall be their peace when the Assyrians come into our land and treads in our places, palaces. Then we will raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 princes of men.
Yeah. So again, same thing. All right. So the idea then is give a portion of this bread to as many as you can, to an indefinite number of people who might, and not just in hopeless situations, as we saw in verse 1, where you're kind of just throwing it away, but rather here we see those who might directly be able to help you someday. So in other words, not just extreme cases like, I don't know, in our context might be African children or homeless people or something like that, but also be generous to all as you have occasion. That might be others in the church, or friends who come over to your house, okay? Ginsberg says, our charity is not to be restricted to these apparently unpromising circumstances, as we saw in verse 1, but it should be of a general character. We are to help by our diffusive liberality, as he puts it, as many as we possibly can, since we know not what a day may bring. Reverses may come upon us, and we may then be relieved by the objects of our former benevolence. Make sense? Okay, so if you are generous with others, then you don't know. They might be generous to you later on. They might help you out when you are in need or when misfortunes come upon you. Okay, so other than giving to the poor, what are some ways we can be generous with other people in our lives? Alakai, why don't you get the other microphone and pass it around? Scott, any ideas?
Well, at work, it's sharing my skills with certain analytical techniques.
Yeah. That's excellent. So at work, helping people out, sharing the experience and the knowledge that you have. Yep. Excellent.
It's paid off that I can sometimes borrow their equipment whenever mine's down.
Yeah. That's just how it works, right? I mean, at my work, too, if I'm kind or gracious when people have a request and I stop what I'm doing to help them out, then they're more likely to help me out if I have an issue. Charlotte.
Giving money to the church or missionaries.
Okay, you could give money to missionaries. Okay. They might come and give you like a recipe or something from the place they're staying. Yes.
Being hospitable, just in your home, sharing meals, sharing your space, opening it up for people, just being kind of that revolving door that people need.
Yep. Yeah. Using your home and your resources to be generous and kind to others. When people come over, you know, give them the best stuff you have, right? Don't give them the cheap stuff that you keep just for the guests, right? Bring out the single-ply toilet paper. All right. I don't think that would save you that much, but. Yeah, you never know. All right, any other examples? What do you think? Alex.
When they have the meal trains, signing up to take someone a meal.
Yeah, sign up for the meal trains. Okay, Ed?
Well, our neighbor many years ago had leukemia within the hospital, so I mowed his yard, and he didn't even know it was me. So, I mean, he could have tell because it went right across. He didn't look, so.
Yeah, right.
But,
okay.
Being able to help a neighbor out who was in need.
Yeah, no, that's great. Excellent. Okay, so we could use our time to help them with some skill, ability we have when they're in need. That's excellent. And so we we know how this works, and we see it all the time. This is, you know, just good reminders. All right, so verse 3. When the clouds are full of rain, they empty it upon the earth. And when the tree falls in the south or north, in the place where the tree falls, there it lies. So this verse speaks to an inevitability. It will rain and the tree will fall, but it also speaks to a certain unpredictability, for who knows when it will rain or when the tree will fall or in which direction. So this picks up the thread we've seen running through much of Ecclesiastes, God's design in his creation and the hiding of his plans from us. Right, so we know certain things are going to happen. We just don't know when they're going to happen. And Solomon uses what he's observed in God's creation around him, the trees and the rain, to illustrate his admonition to generosity in the previous two verses. So just as we see, this kind of addresses what you were saying earlier, Alex, just as we see God's character in the rain and trees falling, we see the same character in the way he rewards our generosity. An inevitability in an outcome paired with an uncertainty in its timing. So in other words, just as we don't know when it will rain or how the tree will fall, we don't know when or how we will be rewarded for our generosity. However, just as we know it will eventually rain and the tree will eventually fall, we also know we will eventually be rewarded for our generosity. In other words, when we are generous with our giving, we can trust that God will reward us in his time and in a way that he deems appropriate. But there's no promise that we will know what that is. Since we have no idea what the future holds or what the present might have been, we have no idea how our generosity affects the blessings that we're currently receiving. So I was thinking of I'm talking to Charlotte earlier, and we're talking about how we might be generous to others. And one of the things that's just a real simple, practical thing is your clothes, right? When you're done with your clothes or you haven't used your clothes in a while, giving them away to someone. And she was saying that we give our clothes away I think you said the hoppers, a lot of our clothes go to the hoppers because they're just a little bit younger, right? And we get a lot of clothes from, from their cousins, right, who are a little bit older. And so they get some clothes, and the ones that don't get totally destroyed get passed down to other people. But what, so one way that we might fail to be generous is just to keep stuff in a bin in the garage for years instead of just saying, you know what, we're not really using that, let's give it to someone and they could put it to some good use. Okay. All that to say, though, that when we are generous by, say, giving clothes away or other things that we're not using, it's not that always that person or the people that we give it to, we're going to receive something back from. We might receive the blessing from someone else in a totally different area, right? And as I was mentioning before, it might be something like your car not having issues or things going well for you in your life or, you know, things like that, that really there's not a one-to-one ratio that your generosity could be paired with. And that's the beauty, I suppose, the uncertainty of a God who is rewarding you, who's in control of all things. Okay? It's not like a person comes and gives you something in response. You had a question there?
How do I turn this on?
It's on.
Oh. In that same line, I was just thinking how the Lord said, when you give, one, don't be aware of what you're doing. Don't let your left hand know what your right hand's doing. And then also, when you have people over, he says, invite the poor because they can't return the favor. And therefore, you are giving gifts that are like your Father in heaven, as opposed to the unbeliever who they all do that. You invite me, I invite you.
Yep. No, exactly. And that's the idea of casting your bread on the waters or sending your bread out on the waters. It's just you're wasting it in a way, like you're kind of throwing it away, it seems like. Yep. Okay. Okay. Verse 4. Whoso therefore, let me translate that. Whoever therefore watches the wind shall not sow, and he who looks at the clouds shall not reap. So watching the wind and looking at the clouds is used here to represent the futility of the person who tries to find God's hidden plan or predict when these things might happen. So this applies to when it will rain and when a tree is going to fall, but equally to how we might be rewarded in our generosity for, or how the bread or monies we will give will be used to bring profit to others or to us. So the watching of the wind and looking at the clouds is also contrasted here with sowing and reaping, the basic measure of work in this society. So the idea being that we should focus on doing the work we have right in front of us and not wasting our time trying to discover God's hidden purposes or dreaming about and trying to predict the future. Okay? Verses 5 and 6. As you know, I'm going to read from this one. As you know, not the path of the life breath into the limbs within the full womb, so you know not the deeds of God who does everything. In the morning, plant your seed, and at evening, let your hand not rest, for you know not which will be fit, this one or that, or whether both be equally good. Okay, so Solomon highlights human ignorance twice in verse 5 and once in verse 6. We know not the course of the wind, and we know not the work of God. And then in verse 6, we know not which will prosper, this or that. So knowledge or ignorance, knowledge of our ignorance, rather, forms the basis of a realistic outlook that depends upon a sovereign, omniscient God. Over hesitancy in making decisions involving risk can result in the best time passing by during inactivity. This means when we make plans or seek to serve the Lord, there is inevitable risk. We don't know which of our plans will succeed and which will fail. Therefore, we should diversify our risk because we don't know which will succeed, this or that. Koheleth draws these conclusions in an unambiguous way. We don't know the work of God or which of all the things we do will succeed, so do all the things God puts in front of you. Be faithful to do the work that he's put in front of you. That's the idea. Right? Sow your seed in the morning and withhold not your hand therefrom in the evening, since you don't know which will prosper. So if you have work to do, do it. Don't dream about something else, right? Do the work that's in front of you. Okay, so how does our uncertainty of the outcome of our actions impact, or how might, let's put it that way, how might that impact our sharing of the gospel? Bridget.
Seizing the moment when you have an opportunity to share, not just waiting around for the perfect opportunity.
Yep. Right, exactly. So if you have a little opportunity in front of you and you think, ooh, I could say this, could say something, instead of waiting for, well, and which ultimately in some sense turns into excuse making, right? Waiting for that perfect time and then doesn't come, right? That fits perfectly, right? Just like if God puts some work in front of us, we do it instead of trying to predict the future and when some other chance is going to come up. How does this impact our giving? Or Scott, feel free to answer either one or something else.
Yeah, just acting in that way is to presume that we know God's plan as well, that, you know, this isn't the moment that God has for me, that plans, let's say if I give here, this won't be as useful as if I give later.
Yeah.
Well, that might not be how God sees it.
Yeah. Well, and it might be something, like I know something that happens with me, I might say in the context of work, instead of using the phrase like Lord willing, I might say, oh, hopefully, or something like that. And I might find myself resisting using phrases that are biblically centered, because I think, oh, and the way I might justify it is, well, they might not understand it, right? It wouldn't mean the same thing to them. But why not say it? Do you know what I mean? Like that. So anyway, just little things like that. I'm assuming things like that happen to all of you as well. There are times when we restrain ourselves from saying things that are clearly God-centered in nature. And we come up with some other way of saying it that fits in more with the culture. Okay. Now, how does our uncertainty of the outcome of our actions impact our giving? Or how might it?
It could cause us to be more hesitant.
Yeah, it might cause us to be more hesitant in our giving. That person's going to spend the money on drugs or alcohol. And those might be legitimate concerns, right? It's not really helping someone who weighs 300 pounds if you give them a gift certificate to McDonald's, right? So how might you then help them? Let's go back to the alcoholic. It's a little easier. How might you then help them and not just walk away from them?
So you could, instead of giving them something like monetary, you could give them food, you could give them a drink, you could give them clothes, you know, something like
yeah.
that they have to physically use.
Sure. Sure.
Instead?
Yeah, you could take some time and talk with them. See if, you know, they do want some food. What are you going to spend the money on? Oh, I'm hungry. I want to go eat. Well, take you out to eat right now or whatever, and we can talk. That's all possible. Zach.
You're just saying that reminded me of a podcast where I was listening to a guy talk about, you know, like helping, say, a homeless person that you see, and let's say you don't have just, you know, a granola bar or some food ready to give them right there. He would say, hey, you know, you look like, you know, and let's say it's a person that's pretty obvious, like, hey, you know, I don't, you know, have anything to like give you right now, but if you want to, I can go take you, you know, to this restaurant near here and, you know, give you a meal. I'll pay for your meal, you know, right now if you want to. And then he would also like try to witness to him or like, you know, talk to him and get to know him or something. So right. It's kind of like evangelism and trying to help him out at the same time.
Right. And that for other reasons might be a bad idea. I mean, you might talk to the person and they're clearly crazy. And so you might not want to do that. Right. I mean, there's certainly a huge correlation between mental illness and homelessness. So, you know, I'm not saying that's always the answer. I'm just saying we shouldn't stop when we see a problem with our generosity. Oh, they might do this. And then we just walk away. It's like, well, they still might be in need. Right. There's still a way we could safely be generous to them, if you want to phrase it that way. Right. Yes.
For me, at times when the homeless are there and they're asking for something, I have felt prompted to give them money, not knowing what they were going to do with it, but saying, Lord, I'm giving this because I feel I want to share with them. What they do with it is their relationship with you. I'm not responsible for that. When I don't know, maybe they really do need the money. And so I'm helping them to do that. But when I'm in doubt, I just give it to the Lord and say they're accountable to you,
sure,
not to me. That
yeah.
helps.
And that's not, in some ways, that's casting your bread upon the waters, right? It's just, I don't know the outcome, right? If I feel led to help this person, I'm going to help them. And again, you don't have to know exactly how it's going to be used. You don't, in fact. However, we're just pointing out ways that, you know, we might recognize this could lead to a problem and not actually help the person. We don't stop there. We think of other ways to be generous to them. Mrs. Palmquist.
I can share. If you're moving on, we can move on. That's
no, go ahead.
I was just going to say, when I was at Agape, there was a story about, you know, you're taking a risk when you help someone, you don't know how they're going to do it. And they were being generous with a gal, and it turns out she was lying to them. And wasn't even a Christian probably, but the Lord ended up convicting her and she ended up confessing to them, like, why are you being generous? And it, I think, was a good reminder of, like, you are taking a risk at something, but God can totally work in their heart and convict them of it.
Yeah.
And you were just walking in faith and obeying. And
yeah, no, exactly. And that's the whole idea. We don't know the future. So we shouldn't sit there and try and predict the future and think that we know what's going to happen and the outcome of what we're doing. If you're right, if we feel convicted, led to help someone, be generous to someone, we should do it. It's the Lord's money anyway. Okay. Matthew 25, 14 to 30. I want to just, we're going to go through this fairly quickly because I do want to get to the end of the chapter so that we can move to the final chapter, not next week, but the week after. For those of you that didn't hear earlier, we're not going to meet next week because there's a congregational meeting. Matthew 25, verses 14 to 30. Would someone like to read that?
25:14-30?
Yes.
And to one he gave 5 talents, and to another 2, and to another 1, to each according to his own ability, and immediately he went on a journey. Then he who had received the 5 talents went and traded with them, and made another 5 talents, and likewise he who had received 2 gained 2 more also. But he who had received 1 went and dug in the ground and hid his Lord's money. After a long time the Lord of those servants came and settled accounts with them. So He who had received 5 talents came and brought 5 other talents, saying, Lord, you delivered to me 5 talents. Look, I have gained 5 more talents besides them. His Lord said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful over a few things, and I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. He also, who had received 2 talents, came and said, Lord, you delivered to me 2 talents. Look, I have gained 2 more talents beside them. His Lord said to them, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of your Lord. Then he who had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. And I was afraid and went and hid your talent in the ground. Look, there you have what is yours. But his Lord answered and said to him, you wicked and lazy servant. You knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. So you ought to have deposited my money with the bankers, and at my coming I would have received back my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to him who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has more will be given, and he who will have abundance. But from him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the unprofitable servant into the outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth.
Okay. So, what I'd like to do is think of some parallels, and we're just going to take a couple of minutes to do this, so don't be hesitant. What the reward of the faithful servant, faithful servants, what's the parallel between that and what we've just been looking at? Did they know what they were going to receive as a reward when the master gave them the talents? No. Did they know when they were going to receive a reward? No, right? So you see a parallel there. You can see that there's an uncertainty about whatever reward might come in the future, and also an uncertainty of when it's what it's going to be and when it's going to come. But you also have a reward for those that are faithful, right? Those that take a risk, those that use the resources and the money that the Lord gives them, and those that are afraid and don't take a risk, right? Squander it. Okay, what are some other parallels you see?
I don't know if this is what you're thinking of, honey, but when you hesitate giving money to a Christian organization that you're trusting is using the money wisely, but you're not sure and you hold back and you don't end up giving anything because you just get confused or you're not sure and people do deceive you with things. I think that would be better to give something to that which you're sure of, but at the same time, I think you would get hesitant to give anything if you checked it out so clearly. I guess, I don't know.
That's no, I appreciate the comment. I'm not thinking, hey, how do we apply these things? I'm more just thinking, what parallels do you see in this Matthew passage with what we've been looking at in Ecclesiastes, right? Uncertainty about the future, okay. A reward that comes from the Lord when we do take risks.
Just doing the work in front of you.
Yeah, doing the work.
Capacity, just do the work.
Exactly. So the people who just got to work and did something, right, they got rewarded. And the one who said, you're made excuses, blamed the Lord for, you know, whatever, not being able to do it, or he's really harsh and demanding, so they just put it away. They're afraid of losing the money. They don't get a reward, right? Or he doesn't get a reward. Alex, you had a...
Yeah, the guy who dug, put his money in a hole is similar to the one who observes the wind.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to predict the outcome.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. He thinks he knows, right? He thinks he knows what's going to happen. The other thing is the reward, and we'll move on. The reward is really out of proportion to what they did. So if you think about it, the Lord didn't say the one who had the five talents, did the Lord take his 10 talents from him at the end? No, he kept it, right? The guy kept it, and he says, hey, give take the talents away from the unfaithful servant and give it to the one who has 10. So he still had the 10, but also the Lord rewarded him with making him ruler over much, right? So he made a little bit of money, the unfaithful wealth, and the Lord gives him great blessing in abundance, okay? And that's kind of like, I didn't write this down, so I'm kind of just winging it, but the passage about he who gives up father and mother in this life will receive not only that, but more in the future. And yeah. So the idea is you'll get blessing here, but then also much greater blessing later. Okay. Verse 7. Back in Ecclesiastes. The light shall be sweet, and it shall be cheering to the eyes to see the sun. So the light and sun are used in the place of life and pair with the clouds, the wind, and especially the morning and day spoken of in the preceding verses. So verse 7 provides, as it were, a ray of hope. If we will act in accordance with the foregoing advice, if we will be benevolent to all of our fellow creatures and diligent in the work God has put before us, we shall find life sweet and have pleasure in living. Light and life will be sweet, and it will be a joy to see each day. So the light will be sweet, and it shall be cheering to the eyes to see the sun. So it'll be a delight to see each day coming. Verse 8, for even if a man should live many years, he ought to rejoice in them all, and to remember that there will be many dark days, that which is coming is vanity. The reason why one should live this way is given here. Our life on earth has many dark and joyless days which will come later in life. The metaphor being used is that of the morning sun and the darkening evening. So enjoy the morning sun because it will be a cold night ahead, you could say. The other reminder Koheleth includes here is that all that comes on earth, the darkness and the light, is mere breath. The darkness, excuse me. The darkness referred to here is not death, but the difficult days ahead in life. Excuse me. So to say that again, the darkness here is not the death that's coming, but the difficult days ahead in life. Koheleth is contrasting the joy of youth and the difficulty of old age. You can see this in the fact that he never refers to the afterlife as mere breath. That is the expression reserved for things of this life, things under the sun. Okay, verse 9. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in your youthful days, and pursue the ways of your heart and the things which are seen by the eyes, and know that, respecting all these, God will bring you into judgment. So here Koheleth again encourages joy and pursuing pleasure, and makes explicit what before he had only implied, that as we enjoy life and pursue the desires of our heart and cheering ourselves, that we do this consciously, holding in our minds the reality that this sovereign God who has made all things and designed the universe to return a man's work unto his own head, this very God will judge each and every one of us for what we do and how we go about pursuing pleasure and the desires of our heart. This then sets the boundary of what is mere breath and what isn't. The coming judgment, obviously, is not mere breath. It is the eternal reality, and everything we do here on earth is significant insofar as it contributes to this judgment one way or the other. The truth should act as a governing, limiting force on our behavior. And we've talked about that before, how the remaining how remaining aware of the coming judgment affects how we live our life on earth. So verse 10, banish therefore sorrow from your mind and put away sadness from your body, for youth and manhood are vanity. So even though we keep in mind the coming judgment, that doesn't mean that we don't or shouldn't be fearful of enjoying ourselves. Let me rephrase that. This doesn't or shouldn't leave us fearful of enjoying ourselves, but rather we should drive out sorrow from our minds and sadness from our body, because this light youth and darkness that comes in old age are both fleeting and insubstantial. Therefore, people must remove grief and anger from their hearts and put away pain from their bodies, because the times of their lives are fleeting. Mankind must never focus on the negatives to the extent that they miss the pleasant opportunities that God gives for their enjoyment. Enjoying the good things requires the proper perspectives on the bad things in life. So after all, the bad is equally ephemeral. The difficult times are just as ephemeral as the great times. Another reading of the expression translated, put sadness or pain away from your body, could be rendered, take evil away from your flesh. In other words, put off sin. Stop following your flesh into sin, but put away that evil. This element of enjoying pleasure while not sinning certainly fits with what Koheleth has been saying throughout Ecclesiastes, and also fits with our immediate context, that we should enjoy life to the fullest, but to remember that this joy is fleeting and that God's judgment will be forever. Therefore, put away the things that will bring us into judgment with the Lord. So to summarize, God summarize 1 to 10, or this chapter, God has a purpose and structure and order to things that he often hides from us. We should give generously. When it's time to work, we should work. When it's time to enjoy, we should enjoy. But always remember that there will be a judgment coming. Not necessarily a punishment. Okay. Alex.
How does that fit with better to be in a house of mourning than in a house of feasting?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Did you have more to the question? Sorry.
No.
Okay. So if you remember, if you were here or listened to the tapes, when we keep in mind the fact that we are coming to an end, our life is coming to an end, that puts us in place of reflecting back on our life and seeing how we should live, right? So after you come home from a funeral, you think more about your life and the significance of what you're doing, right? So you're less likely to focus on insubstantial, insignificant things like money and pleasures, and to focus more on the weighty things of our time here. Does that make sense? That's very similar to the notion of pondering that there is going to be a judgment someday. Therefore, what I do here, I should keep that in mind, right? If I spend all my time doing things that I have perfect Christian liberty to do, like watching movies and playing games, nothing wrong with that. But if you're spending all your time doing that, you're probably not building up much treasure in heaven either, right? But if you're thinking about that, dwelling on those things like death, judgment that's coming, you're more likely to do things of value with your time. Things of eternal and significant value. Does that make sense? Okay. Any other questions or comments? All right, well, go forth and enjoy yourselves.